Hello, everybody, and welcome to an episode of Untied Methodism, where we unravel the past to make sense of today. I'm your host, Dr. Ashley Bogan, the General Secretary of the General Commission on Archives and History of the United Methodist Church. And joining us today is Dr. Philip Wingeyer Ryo. He was born in Singapore to missionary parents and grew up in Evanston, Illinois. Dr. Ryo currently serves as Professor of Missiology, World Christianity, and Methodist Studies at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. He teaches courses in the areas of missions, world religions, and Methodist history and doctrine. He served as Dean of Wesley from 2018 to 2022 and earned a Ph.D. in Theology, Ethics, and Culture from Chicago Theological Seminary. Dr. Wingeyer Ryo's research and interests are at the intersection of missiology, Methodist studies, Pentecostalism, migration studies, and liberation theology. His academic work is informed by 15 years of missionary service, where he served in Nicaragua, Cuba, Mexico, and the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas, near the border with Mexico. He's the author of 5 published books, and his most recent publication is entitled John Wesley and the Origins of Methodist Missions, and is available for pre-order from Abingdon. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us, too.
Thank you, and thank you for that generous introduction.
So, as I was talking about a couple minutes ago when we were kind of chatting before hitting record, so many United Methodists today, when we think about United Methodism as this worldwide membership or worldwide denomination, we immediately think of the United States, Europe, Africa, and the Philippines. But there are a lot of Methodists in other places in the world, including Latin America and South America. And that's what we brought you on today to kind of tell us a little bit about. So for people who don't know anything about Methodism, kind of, as we might say, south of the border, how would you tell the story of Methodism coming to Latin America?
Well, that is a topic that's very close to my heart. As you mentioned in the intro, I served as a missionary for 15 years in Latin America, along with my wife. And Methodism is alive and well south of the Rio Grande, the border with Mexico. And for someone that doesn't know anything about Methodism in this part of the world, it's a historic denomination. It's a denomination that goes back to the 19th century. There were several missionaries who traveled to Latin America, and initially it was off limits because the Roman Catholic Church held a stronghold over the region and did not allow Protestants to go in. They were considered heretics. But some brave souls did that anyway. Some went as Bible peddlers and found alternative ways to share the gospel, and some were even persecuted for that. They'd have bricks or rocks thrown at them. Some were thrown in prison. And then you had businesses that came in. British and American companies started to build railroads. There were mining companies. And so they brought their faith with them. And so the first Methodist churches were actually English-speaking because it was prohibited to do anything related to evangelism. But gradually, missionaries did go in and started reaching out to the Spanish-speaking populations. And so Methodist churches were planted in Mexico, for example, 1873. William Butler, along with his wife, Clementina Butler, they had been missionaries in India, and they were transferred to Mexico. And they purchased a former Catholic church in Mexico City, which was the first Methodist church in Mexico. And they were able to find a Methodist. It was actually a Roman Catholic priest who was fed up with the Catholic Church. And so he was willing to switch and become ordained a Methodist by the name of Alejo Hernandez. So he was the first Mexican ordained as a Methodist pastor. And gradually, a Methodism spread towards the end of the 19th century, and was planted in countries, South America, Peru, Chile, Argentina, Bolivia, and in Central America, especially Panama, with the building of the Panama Canal. There were a lot of Jamaicans who came as laborers, and they were Methodists. And so they brought their faith, and they worked on the railroad and the Panama Canal and started Methodist churches in Central America. So you're right. You don't think of United Methodist churches, but Methodism is very much alive in Latin America.
And these were all missionaries from the Methodist Episcopal Church. Is that correct?
Yeah, either Methodist Episcopal or Methodist Episcopal Church South. So after the division in 1844, there were mission boards from both churches sending missionaries into Latin America.
With those two denominations, kind of the what we might refer to as the Northern Church, or the MEC, and then the MEC South, were they in competition with each other, kind of spreading throughout Latin America? Or was there kind of a respectability of, you know, sometimes you see comedy acts, right, where different denominations will say, okay, you take this region and we'll take this region, so that there's not competition. But I know at least in the U.S., you know, the MEC was throughout the South kind of trying to really compete with the MEC South. So did that happen in Latin America too?
That's a great question. There were comedy agreements. So in new regions, they did try to work separately to not be in competition with one another. But there's an interesting example in Mexico City itself, where the Methodist Episcopal Church South started a church, and the Methodist Episcopal Church, the Northern Church, started a church. And they're not too far away. And they're today still in existence. And even today, you can sense a different tradition, a different theology. You go and worship in both churches, and the liturgy, the theology is slightly different. And it's been 150 years.
Yeah. Oh, fascinating. So what happens, kind of, we see, you know, missionaries coming in from either the MEC or the MEC South, establishing these churches. What then, how does Methodism continue to develop? Where is it thriving? And does it take on kind of a flavor of its own in these different spaces?
Great question. So the missionaries were very strategic. And so they worked along the railroad lines. And they saw that merchandise was carried along railroad lines. There were factories. And so they tried to focus where there would be population centers. And schools were extremely important for the development of Methodism. The Protestant church in general felt that the Catholic church was not doing a good job of discipling their believers. And people did not know how to read and write. So Methodist churches, Presbyterian churches, Episcopalian churches, they started schools where right beside the church, there was a school building. And so children could learn to read and write, and they would also learn about the Christian faith. And this was also just contributing to what missionaries saw as the good of society, teaching people how to participate in a democracy, learning how to read and write and have thinking skills, and to have a career, right, a profession. And so the schools helped Methodism to grow and expand its base. And then in the 1870s, the Catholic Church lost its control over Latin America. And there was a bit of a struggle of power. And so the Protestants began to use the ideals of the Enlightenment, ideals about freedom, about critical thinking, freedom of assembly, and there was a power struggle. For example, in Mexico, there was a dictator by the name of Porfirio Diaz. He ruled from 1884 to 1911, and he was in support of the Catholic Church. And so these Protestant ideals with their schools and teaching people how to think and to express their ideals challenged the stronghold of the Roman Catholic Church. And so this led to the Mexican Revolution in 1911 with Emiliano Zapata. And actually, the writing of the Plan de Ayala, was the expression where land and liberty, you know, that the land should belong to the people who worked it. And this was the revolution that ousted Porfirio Diaz from power. The author, one of the authors of this plan, was a Mexican Methodist Sunday school teacher. And so his ideals from his faith led him to challenge the authority of this dictator and also the hegemony of the Roman Catholic Church. So these ideas of freedom and critical thinking and freedom is what led to the Mexican Revolution and helped to democratize society.
Wow. There's so much to unpack there. You know, it's fascinating that, you know, within the United States, Methodism kind of developed alongside the United States government, right? We see kind of the conversations about freedom and citizenship and liberty and what all these things mean, kind of both and how Methodists are informing the conversations and being informed by the conversations. And so thank you for providing us with that kind of history that the United States was not the only place where that happened. It's just so fascinating. I'm going to have to find a biography. Remind us of the Sunday school teacher's name again, who was one of the authors of the plan.
His name was Otilio Montaño.
Okay, I'm writing that one down because that's so fascinating. So who are some other kind of key players that if persons are wanting to learn more about Methodism in Latin America that we could turn to kind of look and get an idea?
Well, there are several people we could point to. I think one early Methodist scholar and leader was a man by the name of Gonzalo Baez Camargo. He was an orphan, and he was adopted by a Methodist pastor in Mexico. And so he grew up as a boy, as a youth in the church, and he was really turned on by Methodism and wanted to study more. And he became a Hebrew scholar. So he learned Hebrew, and he joined the Bible Society and would translate books of the Bible from the original Hebrew into Spanish. And that was just his moonlighting job. He had a day job as a journalist. He had a column for a newspaper in Mexico City called The Excelsior. And he actually wrote under a pseudonym by the name of Gregoire. And so by day, he would write these columns in the newspaper. And on his free time, he was a biblical scholar. But he became a Mexican leader for not just the Methodist Church, but for Protestantism. So the mission boards would get together for these missionary congresses every so often. And he was invited to attend and often be a representative of the church in Mexico and the church in Latin America. So he was a very prominent voice. There was a meeting in Havana in 1929 where he spoke up and said, you know, you missionaries, you're great. You know, you've been planting churches and we really appreciate your help. But where is the Latin American voice here? Like, you know, we need to take control of our church and become leaders if we're going to be the future of this church. And so there was two reports written to that meeting. One was written in English by the missionaries, and he took it on himself to write a report in Spanish about the findings of this meeting in Havana. And so that's when Mexican or Methodism started to have a little bit more of a Latin American flavor to it. And when they had these congresses, more and more Latin Americans were present, and they brought their ideas, their culture, and they started to capture the future of leadership. So González Baez Camargo is one that I would lift up. Another leading scholar who we are blessed that we still have her with us is Elsa Tamez. She is a New Testament scholar who is from Mexico. And she grew up Presbyterian, but became a Methodist. And she has written several books about how do we interpret the Bible from the perspective of the poor and from the perspective of women, from the marginalized. And so she has really helped us to reflect from a Methodist perspective, what does it mean to read the Bible from the view of the marginalized, from the view of women who have often been excluded? So that's another voice that I would lift up. And then a third one is Jose Miguez Bonino. He lived between the years of 1924 and 2012. He was Argentinian or Argentine. And he had the very special privilege of being invited to the Second Vatican Council between 1962 and 1965 as a Protestant observer. And there weren't too many Protestants who were invited. And so he brought a Protestant perspective to what was happening in the Second Vatican Council and all of the changes that were happening with the Roman Catholic Church, with more lay participation, and also interpreting the Bible from the perspective of the marginalized. So he was a leading Methodist voice in Latin America and wrote a book called the Los Rostros del Protestantismo en América Latina, the Faces of Protestantism in Latin America, which is an important contribution to theology in the Latin American region.
Thank you. And I believe, I think we have some of Bonino's papers in the GCH archive related to Vatican II, because we have some stuff on Vatican II, which is always fascinating to look through kind of from the perspective of a Methodist repository. So 1870s, you said Catholicism is kind of on its way out, is losing some status. Protestantism's gaining. Methodists are kind of integral in laying the foundation for the ideals that lead to revolutions. Are we seeing kind of during this time, you know, oftentimes when missionaries would go out to other places and spaces, they would establish kind of missionary conferences. Are we seeing any kind of like missionary conference or any structure or polity that's looking like an annual conference? And then was there representation, kind of local indigenous representation back within the Methodist Episcopal Church? Or what was that relationship like early on?
Yeah, no, those are important points. Yeah, there were six missionary conferences by the different regions. So in Latin America, you have the Southern Cone and you have the Andes region and then the Central American region, Mexico. So there were six missionary conferences into the 20th century. And you talked about indigenous representation. There were two major world events that started to change these missional conferences. One of them was the Cultural Revolution in China in 1949. And what happened with that revolution is that the government intervened and took over a lot of the church's infrastructure. So universities and campgrounds and hospitals. And the second one was 10 years later with the Cuban Revolution in 1959. And similar, the government intervened and took over hospitals and universities and schools. So the mission board became concerned. And at this time, you know, 1950s, 1960s, you have the Vietnam War. You have a lot of self-determination movements going on around the world, in Africa, independence movements. Countries are overthrowing the colonial powers. And so you have this wave of self-determination movements, and the mission board starts getting concerned, because if there would be kind of a domino effect across Latin America, they would be worried that the same thing that happened in Cuba could happen in Bolivia, could happen in Argentina, could happen in Peru. And the missionaries had started these institutions. So there was conversations about indigenizing the church, handing over the leadership of the church. So the Methodist Church, at that time it was the Methodist Church, started a commission that uses the acronyms COSMOS, which stands for the Commission of the Structure of Methodism Overseas. So this commission starts to meet and starts to look at Methodism around the world, and they enter into conversations with the leaders in the different regions and say, would you like to become autonomous? You're Methodist, but would you like to kind of have the keys to the car, right? And you take over, you elect your own Episcopal leadership, you develop your own book of discipline, you decide the course of the future of your denomination. And part of that was this fear of the spread of communism. But it was also missional, because from the very beginning, it was understood that the gospel is contextual, and it really shouldn't be taught or preached from the perspective of white Anglos. It should really take root, and you should develop your own theology that fits with your people, with your worship style. And so it furthered the mission for churches to have autonomy, to have the authority to make changes as needed. So this Cosmos Commission met, and there was a very important meeting in Green Lake, Wisconsin in 1964. Representatives came from around the world, and each church could decide for themselves what was best. Would you like to become autonomous? Would you like to remain United Methodist? Which is why we have this strange configuration, right? Where we have United Methodists in Africa and the Philippines and in Europe. And so most of Latin America decided to become autonomous. And that happened about the same year as the Union, 1968. So several of these churches in Latin America, right in there, 1967, 1968, Chile was as late as 1973. But different countries in Latin America gained their autonomy in that window of time. And so now they elect their own bishops. They can make changes to the Book of Discipline, and they're self-sufficient economically. And so that was really the move towards the indigenization of the church. And missionaries had to back off. And the mission board started sending less missionaries, and the churches developed their own pastors, trained their own pastors, and were able to make changes as they saw fit.
That explains so much. And I remember reading about Cosmos for the first time, really, in Methodism and American Empire, which is a book that you contributed to. And it's such a good book. I've recommended it numerous times on this podcast. I'm teaching it in Methodist history this year. But yeah, Cosmos, it seems like one of those committees that we should know more about, especially kind of given what's going on in United Methodism right now. Like it seems pretty relevant to the current conversations about regionalization, about decolonization, all of these things. So can I ask a couple further questions about this? Why do you think certain Latin American countries decided to become autonomous when it came to the Methodist Church, when other places, you know, we can just use, for example, like Africa and the Philippines didn't necessarily do so? Was it a political move? Was it a religious or a connectional move? Like what was going on in your mind?
The answer to that question depends on which country and what their particular context was, what was happening in their region at that time. In the case of Latin America that I'm more familiar with, these self-determination movements were very strong. And so countries were very proud of their history, their culture. And the Methodist Church, and really Protestantism in general, was seen by some people as an imposition from the United States, where the United States was trying to teach their way of life. And so if the Methodist Church was literally a part of the United Methodist Church in the United States, it was a branch. It was really hard to get your message across because you felt like you were selling yourself out, right? To join the Methodist Church was, in a sense, to turn your back on your culture, on your history, on the pride of what it means to be a citizen of your country. And so it hurt the mission of the church to be associated with the United States. And so by accepting autonomy or gaining autonomy, it freed that church up to say, no, we're not an outpost from the United States. We are citizens of this country. We are Christians, and we run our own church. And so it allowed the mission to become contextual, to speak the language of the people, to adapt the music, the liturgy, and to celebrate what it meant to be a citizen of that country. So I think in order to respond to that question, you have to ask yourself, you know, what's happening in different parts of the world at that time? In Africa, they were still in the throes of those independence movements. A lot of countries in Africa gained their independence from the colonial powers in the 1960s. So I think at that moment, they were just in so much turmoil that it was difficult to even consider, you know, taking on the responsibility of running the church. But I think that'd be a great question. You know, you can invite somebody from Africa and ask them, you know, why did you choose not to become autonomous at that time? You know, how did they respond or participate to the conversations of Cosmos?
And I think, you know, at this most recent general conference, is it parts of Eurasia became autonomous or voted to become autonomous, right? So this isn't something that's necessarily only within the past. This is still an active part of the Book of Discipline that the different regions can live into or different annual conferences. So,
yes. And there was a missionary bishop in India. He was one of the first Methodist missionaries in India. His name was James Thoburn. And he wrote, here we are planting this church in India, but the goal of it is to become independent. I mean, every church really should become part of that fabric. You know, a church should never remain colonial, right? You know, should never be an imposition. It should always bear roots and grow and take on the flavor, the history, the culture of that society. So that bishop, from the very beginning, his vision was, you know, we're planting this church in India, but ultimately we hope that the people will take over. They will become the leaders. They'll become the drivers of the church in their country.
I think that's the way the Methodist Church in Britain has historically operated too. Their missionaries would go out and the spaces where they went, it was believed or it was practiced that those mission outposts would become autonomous affiliated denominations. And so it you know, brings up all of these questions about, you know, I guess theological questions of how do we understand, how do we decolonize connectionalism, right? Of still being connected as the United Methodist Church, but without that imposition and with uplifting, empowering local persons to kind of do ministry according to their context. And that's where I think regionalization is hoping to do some of that. So this is fascinating stuff.
Yeah, it's about decentering.
Yeah.
The United States as the center of power, because when these churches were started, the mission board was kind of like the sender. The missionaries were sent out. So it was a very colonial model. But now, as these churches are fully capable of sustaining themselves and they elect their own bishops, their own leadership, they worship in their own language. Well, what does it mean now to be partners instead of having this paternalistic relationship? And so I think you're absolutely right. That's what the regionalization plan does, is it makes the United States one region, just like any other region around the world. So we would be able to adapt the Book of Discipline to our context, where we are in ministry, as the other central conferences can already do.
You have kind of a question about, I guess, heritage or the way Methodism is talked about, particularly in Latin America. And that's, I think what I'm curious about is, you know, when people talk about the founders of Methodism, do they mostly refer to John Wesley, or is the story of kind of the Methodist Episcopal Church also told in Francis Asbury and the missionaries, or are there pieces that persons prefer kind of as their origin story?
Well, you are a historian, so you will appreciate this question. There are purists who think, you know, we should go straight to John Wesley, right? He was the founder of Methodism, and so we should bypass American Methodism and go straight to the source. And there was a big change in Latin American Methodism when the works of Wesley were translated into Spanish. And it's kind of crazy that it took so long. There were some of his sermons that were translated, but his works were not completed in Spanish until 1998. Justo Gonzalez, a great Methodist church historian, was the editor. And so that allowed Wesley to be available in Spanish. And so it created this excitement around Methodism. We had access in Spanish. And I was actually teaching in the Methodist Seminary in Mexico City at the time. And the students were just so thrilled to be able to read Wesley. And we just teach a whole semester class and just read the original source, right? Reading Wesley in his own words. So that's kind of the purest interpretation to your question. But the way that Methodism arrived in Latin America was filtered through the experience of the Methodist Episcopal Church. So Wesley never did go to Latin America. It was missionaries, Methodist missionaries, right, who traveled and brought their interpretation of what Methodist theology was. So yes, it was filtered through the eyes, through the experiences of those American Methodist missionaries. But today, you know, some people are more purists and other people realize, well, this is what we actually inherited. This is what we receive, even though it was filtered through the eyes and the experience of American Methodists.
So what do you have any kind of other stories that you wanted to highlight on this episode?
Yes, I would like to share that when the Cosmos Commission met and negotiated with the leaders of the Methodist churches in Latin America, there was a promise that even though the churches became autonomous, that they would still be considered part of the United Methodist Church. They would still could be considered part of the Methodist family. And that has not always materialized. In fact, Elaine Robinson, who's a professor at St. Paul School of Theology, wrote an article, and in there she uses the frame, the exile of Methodists in Latin America. In a sense, they were invited to become autonomous, but because of the way the United Methodist Church works today, they aren't always included. For example, funding. There are scholarships. There is grant opportunities that is available through the general boards and agencies. And sometimes the requirement is that you are a United Methodist. And so somehow the Latin American Methodists feel a little shortchanged. Like, okay, yeah, we took up your offer to become autonomous, but now we're not exactly part of the same family. And the agreements that they have is that they're often invited to general conferences as a delegate with a voice, but without a vote. So through the agreement as being an affiliated autonomous church, they get one lay and one clergy delegate that can sit at general conference and they can speak, but they can't vote. And so they feel a little gypped, right? That, yeah, we're Methodists and, you know, we're a part of you, but we don't necessarily get a seat at the table where decisions are being made. And the economy in Latin America is not that great, right? And so I think they could really benefit from United Methodists that remember this history, remember how interconnected we are, and to include Latin Americans. Here in the United States, the Latino, Latina, Latinx population is very strong. There's about 50 million people of Hispanic, Latino descent in the United States. And so it's very prominent in the U.S. culture, in the U.S. society. But within United Methodism, Latinos are underrepresented. It's disproportionate So if you look at the number of delegates to General Conference, I think it's under 1% those who are of Latino, Latina descent. And population-wise, 50 million, they're about 16, 17, 18% of the U.S. population. So there's a disproportionate representation of Latino, Latina Methodists in the United Methodist Church. And so I think it'd be important for us to remember those roots. And I know a lot of churches that have relationships. They support ministries in Latin America. A lot of churches take short-term mission trips to Latin America. And so just remember that we have those historical ties. And just because they chose to become autonomous doesn't mean that they stopped being Methodists or they stopped wanting to be in relationship with the United Methodist Church.
I'm going to let that kind of be the final statement, because I think that's a great kind of call to action to our listeners to not only kind of know this history, but to embrace it and find ways to continue to be in community with Methodist churches kind of around the world. Thank you so much, Dr. Wingayo Rayo. We appreciate you.
Thank you for the conversation. It was very lively, and I hope it's been helpful for our listeners.
It's been great. This has been another episode of Untied Methodism. We will see y'all next time.